from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome to Where Are Y'all Really From, a podcast about Asian Americans in Kentucky. I'm your host for this episode, Dan Wu. My guest today is filmmaker Naveen Chobel. Naveen has worked for AJ Plus, Vice News, and Bon Appetit, and produced music videos for the likes of James Blake and Frank Ocean. His works include the short film Pinball, and he co-shot and co-produced the feature documentary Tomorrow We Disappear. Welcome to the show, Naveen.
Thanks, Dan.
So we always start off the show with kind of talking about the name of our show. And as Asian Americans, we've all been asked that question somewhere between one and a trillion times a day.
Yeah, definitely.
When you get asked that question, how do you answer it and how do you feel about it?
Yeah, it's still kind of jarring in a way. And, you know, there's a million answers that run through your head every time it's asked. But I think it really depends on who's asking and like where in the conversation that's happening. Is it up top? Is that the first thing they want to know? You know, if that happens, I generally kind of go with Indiana because that's where I was born. And I want to give them the answer that they don't want.
Right.
In a way, I want to confront that right away. And then it's interesting to see where the conversation goes. If it's further along and you get a sense of where they're coming from and what the conversation has been rolling into, then I might go into, you know, India via Indiana and maybe make a joke about how,
yeah,
I used to make a joke about my parents, but they moved to Indiana because it had India in the name. Yeah. just to throw people off, but it's kind of my own little joke to myself. But
so how did your parents end up in Indiana? Not just Indiana, but like a small town in Indiana, Munster, right?
Yeah. My dad is an engineer. So he came over in the late 70s for his master's and did some, you know, post-grad work here. And then my older brother was actually born in Utah when he was finishing up his PhD. And then he got a job at a steel mill doing research in Indiana because there's, you know, kind of a steel belt up in northern Indiana on Lake Michigan. And yeah, he got a job there and has been working at the same company since. And that's where I was born and where I spent my entire, you know, childhood until college.
Were there a lot of either Indians or South Asians or just Asian Americans in general in a place like Munster, Indiana?
It started off sparse. And luckily we were close to Chicago. So I think there was a small movement of people moving from Chicago to Northwest Indiana. But it was pretty sparse until middle school, high school. Then there was more of an influx of people, but it was a kind of town where like you knew every single Indian family and they were, you know, a group of us luckily that were around the same age. So I was able to go through kind of a schooling experience with like a core group of, you know, four or five friends who we all went through school together and kind of created these friendships that have lasted so long now.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes it feels like a microaggression when somebody finds out that you're Indian or you're Chinese, and then they suddenly ask like, oh, do you know Steve Wong?
Yeah.
Dave Patel? And in your case growing up, you were like, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
So your dad was an engineer and you were originally going to head towards engineering, right? What veered you off your path and how did your parents take it?
It's a funny story because, you know, I'd have to credit my brother with that. He kind of ventured off the path first and went to NYU initially, kind of on like the pre-med path, but auditioned for the art school there and got in. And I think because, you know, stereotypically in a way, my parents saw that it was, you know, one of the best art school in the country. Okay, maybe there's something there. Maybe this is something that, you know, he could pursue. And that was around the time that I was looking at schools. And I'd always made films here and there for fun, for school projects. I'd always try and sneak in maybe doing a video instead of writing a paper for, you know, English projects, Spanish projects, that kind of thing. And it wasn't until he kind of got in into an art school that I realized that this is something that's even feasible. I didn't even know film schools existed. I had no idea that it was something that you could study. It just wasn't in a realm of possibility.
Yeah.
And that's when I started looking at schools and realizing, oh, there's like classes that you can take to writing screenplays and creating small short films. Or what are short films? I had no, you know, I had made stuff on my own and didn't really think about the time length, you know, which is crazy now because we would make 40-minute, 50-minute films for like an English project and like edit it in one day, shoot it in 2 days. It was kind of an insane process, but
yeah, it's kind of fun. What you can accomplish when you don't know what's not
possible. Yeah.
we can do this. And then looking back, you're like, wow. How did we even come up with that? When you were growing up, you know, did you see much just in media in general and particularly in movies, did you see much, you know, representation that looked like you? And when you saw it, like, how did you feel? Like, were there particular films or particular actors or filmmakers that played with you?
I mean, the short answer is, you know, there's definitely was not representation, but it is interesting coming from an Indian background because obviously the Indian film industry is, you know, huge, maybe the biggest in the world in terms of volume of films. So there was always a sense of cinema that was kind of consumed in our house. And my mom is a big film person, so she would always try and, you know, rent the bootleg DVDs, VHS tapes, and try and watch it, but we'd always get frustrated with the quality of it, but still watch it. So it was kind of interesting to see both. And obviously you're watching, you know, American films and you're not seeing yourself depicted, but even you're watching these Indian films and obviously those stories, there's a connection, but there's still a huge disconnect. So you're really not seeing yourself in either of these stories, but you're supposed to. And also there still is some small connection. And especially for me as a filmmaker, there was still this sense of getting lost in these stories, which was kind of really interesting. But it wasn't until, you know, in more recent times where you really felt the difference when you actually could see someone like yourself depicted on screen and how that completely changed a similar story that you would see.
Yeah. You remember, so one of the movies that I always kind of trot out as in some ways revolutionary for Asian American representation is Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
Yeah.
By the simple fact that it's not about them being Asian whatsoever. Yeah. It's pure dumb stoner comedy that happens to, you know, star an Indian American and a Korean American.
Yeah.
You remember seeing that movie and like how your feelings about that?
So I might be a bad person to talk to because I have not seen it.
No.
But I do remember the time when it came out and it was kind of controversial, I think, at least for me, because it was a torn feeling of like, should I go see it or should I not? And I just didn't end up seeing it. But
I didn't see that movie until really recently because honestly, not my type of movie whatsoever.
Yeah.
But then when I started kind of thinking more about representation and ideas and stuff, and then you start digging through, and you know, there aren't that many movies with Asian American leads. So discover that, and it was exactly what I thought it was. It was a big dumb funny movie, but just the fact that the two of them were in it, I think, was pretty
funny.
Here's a weird question. How do you feel about Apu from The Simpsons? Speaking of representation.
Yeah, it's troubling, but it is interesting because I think that character to me also reminds me of Peter Sellers' character in The Party. Yeah. And it obviously they're both played by white men. And it's like as a child, you just didn't think anything of it and didn't think it was problematic at all. Even the Peter Sellers movie, I thought it was hilarious growing up, just because it was just, in a way, that was like the closest form of representation. You know, it felt like, in some ways, kind of the way that we would make fun of, you know, certain people who we know, you know, who were reminded of those people that, quote unquote, came fresh off the boat in a way. But it wasn't until later that we understood how, in a way, sad that was, that these were the only characters that we could have, characters that made fun of us in a way, and that we made fun of, that it wasn't the gambit, it wasn't the spectrum.
Yeah. And you went to film school probably about 10 years ago?
Yeah, a little, I guess graduated in 2010, yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the movies that you all studied, do you feel like there was a decent amount of sort of inclusive or diverse representation in the movies that you studied, both from who's in these movies, but also filmmakers?
Yeah. They didn't do the greatest job, I think, in terms of the history. They would have specialty classes, you know, Indian cinema, Chinese cinema, Korean cinema, but in terms of history and the films that we would watch from the early 1900s, it definitely didn't address the global sense of cinema. It was definitely highly European, and I guess in a way it makes sense for a little bit, because it started in, really, filmmaking started in France, at least a kind of a feature length France and Germany. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely people who were tinkering in a lot of other countries. There's a famous Indian filmmaker, Harish Chandra III, who went to Europe and saw some of these early films and came back and basically started his own little studio, his own little factory, and started making short films that were seconds long, and played around with it and was experimenting, but we didn't study him. And I'm sure there's so many more examples of people who were tinkering in probably similar ways that people in Europe were, but also putting their own little spin on it and trying things out. You know, it would have been interesting to see why music became so popular in India at the time. Why were they making films with people singing and lip syncing at such an early time in the 30s and 40s? You know, what were those early films over there trying to sync the sound? That would have been so interesting to learn about and try and understand that.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like I've, being in the food industry, I've talked to friends and chefs who have gone through culinary school, and it's kind of a story that it's the main line of their curriculum is European based, you know, culinary arts, and then they spend, you know, a couple of classes on Asian food or you know, Latin food.
Yeah,
so it always feels like it's just it's like an elective.
Yeah, exactly.
No way.
No, that's perfect, because that's exactly what it was. The requirement classes were one thing, and then the electives were Indian cinema or Chinese cinema, Korean.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Where Y'all Really From, a podcast from LPM, Louisville Public Media. Welcome back to Where Y'all Really From.
So you made your own short film recently called Pinball, and it's a narrative short film, and it's kind of around a really weird little subject that a lot of people haven't heard of: school bus racing in Indiana. Tell us about like what that's all about and how you came about it, how you found that subject.
Yeah, I was in Los Angeles for school and spent a lot of time there afterwards and didn't have a car. So had to take the bus everywhere. And if you take the bus in LA, it's kind of a interesting experience because not a lot of people who I knew were, they all had cars. And this idea of riding the bus and using it as a form of transportation and the kind of stories that you would just see unfold every day just kind of fascinated me. And I just started researching buses. And my girlfriend, Bryn, who's now my partner, producer, collaborator, she's a filmmaker in her own right, she was living in Guatemala at the time and said, there's a really interesting way that they use buses for public transportation there because they get old American school buses that are, you know, not fit for American kids anymore. And they get bought and at an auction and driven down there, and they get converted into these pieces of art painted with murals. They're even baptized, and that becomes the form of transportation for the everyday person there. And through researching there and seeing those kinds of buses, I found this little YouTube video of a speedway in Jeffersonville, Indiana. And I was just kind of shocked that, yeah, this world exists. And I couldn't really believe it. And then lo and behold, when I was researching, there was a race the next day. So I was actually visiting my parents in Munster and just drove down and met the owner of the speedway, who was kind of like this, almost like a circus ringmaster, just loved hanging out at the speedway, loved the thrill of it, loved the sense of like festivities race night created. And to me, going there, it was really interesting because it was an overwhelmingly white crowd. I definitely stood out. And it was interesting though, because he gave me a pass to go to the pit. Mm. And I just walked around, and people obviously didn't know who I was and didn't recognize me or kind of were off put by me. But once I started talking to them about what they were doing and where I was coming from and why this was fascinating to me, there was just a connection. You know, the politics didn't matter for you know, a night, and where I'm coming from didn't matter, where they were coming from didn't matter. It was just about, why are you racing? What is it about racing these school buses that you find interesting? And it was just fascinating to me. And then that's where it was always this sense of, how do I tell the story of an outsider? And this was the perfect kind of setting for me, was how can we flip the switch a little bit and kind of make kind of a magical kind of folktale short film that doesn't hit that sense right on the head so hard, but kind of subtly kind of addresses this theme of a young kid who's not supposed to be in the speedway, doesn't belong. But somehow finds his way in, can't help but wants to fit in, wants to be a part of it, wants to be a part of this community.
Yeah. Did it help when you were sort of backstage, as it were, in this event and talking to people? Did you ever drop that you were from Indiana? And if so, did that help?
It did. It did. Yeah, that's a good way. It was like, because I, you know, it was a connection point. And, you know, when you're that outsider and you're trying to fit in, yeah, you're pulling at any string that you can feel a connection with these people. And that's actually how we were able to, I think, kind of almost make friends with some of these people. And they opened their doors. We would even meet with them for like dinners and talk to them about, you know, what kind of cars they're working on and what they plan to do. Cause the races are kind of a WWE style, slightly choreographed. So they would kind of tell us what they hope to do in the next race. And maybe this person can win the race, or maybe this person can kind of flip, or, you know, we can have a crash on, you know, circle 8 once we get halfway into the race, kind of thing. So wow. It's kind of interesting to see how they approached everything.
Yeah, I watched a lot of wrestling when I was a kid, and I did not appreciate until I was an adult how much of that whole genre is storytelling, how much of that is not about just dudes slapping each other in a ring.
Yeah.
Like all these narrative arcs and character arcs. It's kind of amazing. And I was listening to another podcast recently, and this woman was saying that she just got hired on to WWE as a writer.
Wow.
Right? And it took me a second to be like, oh yeah, that's a thing. Like, yeah. Write these stories. It's kind of great.
Yeah, and that was such an amazing thing too, is, yeah, these are creative people too. Like this is the way they express themselves. And they save up money. They not only you know, race buses, but they also race other cars. Not in a demolition derby style, but they save up money and they're trying to build out their cars. And they're getting paint and painting these buses too, in like ways that they find interesting. Even though it's kind of seems like a slapdash job. You know, they spend time painting it and trying to figure out how to get it run. And it's some pretty creative people there.
Yeah. You've done a good amount of commercial work for the likes of The Gap and Bon Appetit and hotels, and also music videos. And you've also done some journalistic stuff for AJ Plus and BuzzFeed. One thing I watched recently, you had shot this little short for AJ Plus, which is a branch of Al Jazeera, A Year Without Eric Garner. Do you find yourself going with a different approach when you're shooting a commercial thing that you know is going to be used in a promotional or a commercial sort of way versus shooting something that's more journalistic?
Definitely. It's two different hats completely. You know, there's a lot of cinematographers who really only live in one of the two, because it can become so specialized. And it's nice to be able to move between the two and take things from each. But in the commercial world, things are planned. Things have a budget and a much stronger sense of schedule that you have to stick to. And you're moving at a much quicker pace with a lot of equipment, and you're trying to get these shots that you have to get at this time. Otherwise you won't get it. And you're usually working with a crew of people, which is kind of a really nice way to work, which is what I love about film. In documentary, it's kind of a free-for-all in so many different ways, because there isn't a set schedule. You don't know what you're supposed to get. You just kind of have to be there and see what happens and hopefully capture it and put yourself in a position. And usually if you're shooting, you don't have a team of people who are supporting you. It's just yourself with the camera. You know, when you do interviews, it's different. You'll have a little bit of a setup, but you know, with documentary, it's so much about like trying to be present in the moment and allow yourself to like slowly feel what's happening and just not interfere and let it unfold.
Yeah. When you're, you know, when you're filming like Eric Garner's daughter or his widow and listening to them talk, when you're working and looking through the lens, does it put you at a, enough of a remove that you can kind of like do your work, or does what's actually happening on camera like filter through and like hit you, you know, in an emotional level, like as a person, and like, how do you balance those things?
That's one of the hardest things, because you're completely torn in a moment like that, where you want to put the camera down and you kind of feel like you're invading, but you understand that this is an important story, and it's a way to show people the reality of situations that they wouldn't normally have access to. But it's so hard, especially when people are recounting stories of such pain and horror. You just want to like put your hand on their shoulder and be a little bit more human. But you try, like, you know, I'll try and kind of nod to them and like understand that I'm not hiding behind this camera. Mm-hmm. I do hear you. And I am like, I can recognize what's happening in this moment.
Do you feel like what do you think filmmaking and that sort of visual storytelling, what do you think the role is of someone like yourself as a filmmaker as it relates to social justice? Like what do you think can be done? What do you think you can do to sort of advance social justice or kind of contribute in that way?
I mean, it's a powerful tool, and it's really interesting to see, especially with cell phones, how you can capture moments that you wouldn't normally see the light of day. And you can find moments where it may not be kind of something explosive happening, but the day after, the week after, the month after, and capturing something where you see someone feeling the weight of it in an everyday moment of life. And I think that's kind of, to me, what I relate to, and I think the kind of the way that I would want to capture something that lends its a message to the social justice movement is what happens after all these events unfold, and how do everyday people deal with these injustices that may have happened recently or years. I think that's kind of a way that isn't so flashy and headline grabbing, but I think that's a really important way that people can use film and video to address some of these issues.
Naveen, we like to end every show with our lightning round questions. Are you ready?
I hope so.
All right, here we go. What is your superpower?
I'd say daydreaming.
Okay. What is your favorite song to jam out to?
There's a couple, but one that sticks out is the introductory music for the starting lineups that the Bulls used in the 90s, the Alan Parsons Project song. It's just, you know, taps into my inner childhood.
Nice. Speaking of that, like if you were like a WWE wrestler, what would be your like intro song? What would be your hype song that you come on stage with?
I guess I would have to use that. Yeah. So that or the theme music that the NBA on NBC used to have.
Yeah.
It was just classic.
That big fanfare. Like,
Yeah.
What's your favorite comfort food?
It's a South Indian dish called rasam. And it's kind of like a soup based off of lentils and tomatoes. You can throw onions in there sometimes. You can drink it itself, but I like to have it with a good helping of rice and ghee. And it just kind of feels right every time.
Do you make it yourself?
I'm trying to learn, but you know, my mom is very protective of her recipes.
Really? From her own?
Yeah, especially from her own children.
Wow.
But it's fun. I try and get a little bit every time I go back, and you know, it's her way of still being able to share some of the things that she loves and bring us back home.
Right. Yeah. You gotta make her promise to like write it down and like put it in an envelope and put it in the will.
Yeah, that's good.
Now that you're in Louisville, Kentucky, what is the most Kentucky thing that you do?
I'd have to say, you know, a nice glass of small batch bourbon after work.
Nice.
Whether it's like editing work or, you know, working in the backyard kind of a thing. It's
kind of
a nice way to end the day.
What's your favorite bourbon?
I'd have to say Rowan's Creek.
Okay.
Yeah. If you haven't had it, definitely get it.
Very nice. Well, Naveen, it's been great talking to you. I appreciate you being on the show.
Thanks, Dan. This is fun.
Where Y'all Really From is created by Dan Wu, Charlene Buckles, Nima Kulkarni, and Mae Surmac, and hosted by Dan and Charlene. Our show is edited by Alex Cooper, and our music is by Kojin Toshiro. Graphic design by Leanne Gann. Where Y'all Really From is part of the Louisville Public Media Podcast Incubator with support from the Community Foundation of Louisville, Podchaser, Rankings.io, and the Eye Care Institute's Butchertown Clinical Trials. Our executive producer is Laura Ellis. For more information and to keep in touch, visit whereyallreallyfrom.org.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.